This is episode 41 of The Job. And this week's guest is Evan P. Schneider. But first, let's talk about the fact that all hell could break loose at any moment because I'm recording this on OS 10 10.10 beta. Thoroughly recursive and humorous name. Yeah. They just don't want to go to 11. Like, no. They'll do anything to keep from going to 11 at Apple.
So you always do this. You upgrade immediately to the developer versions, and then all hell does break loose for...
It does, yeah. Yeah. And I did this on my primary work computer. Yeah. Hilarious.
As usual. And your iPad, which I had to use...
You tried to watch HBO Go, and it was a no-go. My work computer, luckily I have an extra for occasions like this. I've learned enough from this that I just move the laptop and switch to the desktop and, you know, keep everything in the cloud, as they say. And so I was able to jump right back in and pretend like no horrible catastrophe had happened. As for my iPad, well... I didn't install it on my iPhone because that's actually the necessary device.
Well, you did last time, and you couldn't get calls for a week.
Yeah, that was
right.
Stupid. Yeah. At least I learned some things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, very excited about that. I wasted half of my day on Monday or Tuesday or whatever watching that silly keynote. No
that
regrets.
That has been the highlight of your... like year since I've known you.
Yeah,
you would plan like vacations around this.
The developers convention. I've never gone to it, but I always manage to either, you know, usually I don't broadcast the keynote. This year, usually I'm able to kind of work while watching Twitter to see what's happening. But this year, like they used to long ago, they actually broadcast the whole thing live. Mm-hmm. Which was a special, rare
treat.
You're
getting teary just thinking about
it. No, those are allergies. Oh. No, I'm not getting teary thinking about this. This is the hot sauce on my fingers.
Ooh, stop rubbing them in your face.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. I'm excited about the fall. I think maybe we should switch to developing for iOS. Joking. We'll just be doing Rails projects for a while.
This is completely unrelated, but we have a child together, more than one. And the youngest one recently discovered Jacobson salt.
Oh, yeah. She's 20 months old.
And she's obsessed. She calls it rice, but she just wants to eat it plain. If I put it on food, she'll find it and pick it out and eat it. I'm convinced that there's like something in that salt. It's like actually cocaine or something. It's like, I've always felt like something was happening there where people were getting really obsessed with it, myself included. But when I saw it happen to like a young child, it's like, what's he putting in that?
Nothing. Salt. They're just big chunks of salt.
That's so good.
It's like no one would take a big, massive pinch of table salt and eat it, but
no,
a big rock of it, you'll just eat that.
You know? More rice? It's like, oh my God.
Oh, God. Well, it does kind of look like rice. Yeah. Certainly big enough chunks.
Yeah. So while you're obsessing over the keynote, I've been obsessing over the fact that that salt with that hot sauce that we've discovered on just plain eggs is like amazing. I never want to cook again. Like those two things together. Well, you have to cook the eggs, but.
Yeah, why would you cook again? Game over.
Drop the mic. So we have friends that just moved back into town after living in Amsterdam for a couple years. And they brought us back boxes of sprinkles. And this is apparently the breakfast of the Dutchess to make
toast
with butter and then sprinkles. So I wonder, maybe that'll be the next thing, next obsession.
Right,
the next rice.
Yeah,
the
$4 new rice. Toast. It's an extra dollar with sprinkles, so... That'll be $5 toast.
That $4 toast is amazing, by the way. Are they talking about that toast in San Francisco?
Yeah. You know what?
You've had it. You have to admit. It's
I could tell amazing. You that I could tell you this. We're working on a top secret project here at Nadmore.
Involving toast?
Involving animations of that toast. Shh. Can I say that? How is that possibly revealing too much?
I don't know.
No one knows what the heck I'm talking about. Yeah, so watch your mailbox, kids.
Top secret.
It's not even really.
It's fun.
You know,
there's a lot of top secret stuff happening around here lately. A lot of password protecting and secret stuff.
Yeah. I'm not good at keeping secrets in business environments. Personally, I am. But I'm kind of a share by default.
Well, to be fair, you're good at keeping client secrets. We're not very good at keeping our own secrets. And I think that that's because oftentimes we have a philosophy that you should share everything about business and that business is better when everybody's talking about things. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, we definitely, if we have a hard time with something or we have an experience that's frustrating, we're likely to blog about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, our blog is full of just business philosophy and what we've learned and blah, blah, blah.
It's full of blog.
Blog.
Evan P. Schneider is editor of Boneshaker magazine. And in 2011, he wrote his first novel, A Simple Machine Like the Lever, about bicycling, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll be hearing more about that.
Plus, he's a fun guy.
He's a fun guy, long affiliated with Literary Arts in Portland that we've worked with.
Well-dressed.
He dresses well.
He does. He always does.
He's got more style in his pinky than I do in my whole life. He's a classy gentleman. So let's talk to Evan P. Schneider.
All right.
So, hi, Evan.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. But enough about me. let's start at the beginning. Where are you from?
Originally, I was born in New Mexico. Then when I was 10 years old, I moved up to Colorado by way of Arizona for 1 year.
Okay.
So I grew up, I was basically raised in Colorado, graduated high school in Colorado, and then went to Colorado State University for undergrad. That's in Fort Collins, which is the northern part. My folks own a place that's about 19 miles from the Wyoming border.
Okay.
So very, very far northern Colorado.
Right. So how'd you end up in Portland?
When I was in Colorado, one of my really good friends moved out this way in about 2000. And I had always heard of the Pacific Northwest and wanted to visit it. I, in sixth grade, had done a project where they asked you to do your dream vacation, plan out your dream vacation. And everybody was picking tropical islands or European countries, and I chose Olympic National Park in Washington. And so I knew I was drawn to the Northwest, the greenery, the moisture. And so when I had a friend move to Portland, I really made a pilgrimage about every year sometime in the spring to visit him. Okay. And that was in 2000. And then it took me 8 years to finally get here, but I made it in about 2008.
Okay. That's funny that you would pick the Olympic National Park.
I'm not sure what it was. I think at some point you used to be able to write to the U.S. Forest Service and request maps of their park, and they would send it to you free. They may still do that, but they're probably now all electronic. But I got it in the mail, and I remember unfolding it, and they had the pictures of just the rainforests and the being from Colorado, especially the non-mountainous part of Colorado where it's dry and flat and brown and very, very, very sunny. I guess I was looking for something that the opposite of that.
Right. Okay. How did you ever become interested in writing? Was this something you were going to school for? Something that dates back before sixth grade? Or
I think it was probably my senior year in high school. I took an English class that I finally put some effort into.
Yeah.
And I remember reading. I was not a very strong reader, even though my mom was a reading teacher and taught me to read very early on. I didn't have the attention span for it. I wanted to be playing outside. I wanted to be running around. And so really, from elementary school up until high school, I didn't read very much at all. I can remember reading two books. I can remember reading Jurassic Park, and then I can remember reading The Lost World, which is its sequel. And that Jurassic Park took me an entire year to read because I was just so slow and could maybe do two pages, and then I wanted to go do something else. Then in high school, I, like I said, my senior year, took this humanities class, and I knew it was going to be a daunting course, so I really put my all into it. And when I read these books, like a Dickens book or philosophy or just other remarkable fiction, I remember having this epiphany of this art would be amazing to be able to try to create. And so then about that time, I started toying with poetry, and I had always I would strive to write fiction, but I wasn't very good at it at that point. So I could understand the constraints of a poem and how to try to get through that. So I started with poetry. My first pieces were poetry pieces. And then I got into book reviewing and hit up the local independent weekly newspaper there in Fort Collins in about 2001. I think I was just about at the end of college. And I just wrote them an email and I said, "Hey, I noticed you don't have any book reviews. I don't know why you don't run any." And I didn't know anything about newspapers or how they're run or what a freelance writer was. I just said, "You should have book reviews." And I wrote one. So here you go. Feel free to publish it. And I didn't hear back. And so I followed up again and I said, "Hey, I just wanted to make sure you got my book review that I wrote. I'd really like you to publish this." Still didn't hear anything. Then on the third time that I reached out saying, "Just wanted to check one more time," I had two different editors write me back. They each thought that they had both responded to me, which they had not. And they said, "We would love to run a book review." So they ran my book review. And then I just, from then on, just tried to write a book review every month for that newspaper.
Interesting. Why? That's interesting. How do you feel about book reviews versus, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but versus actually writing a book, or, you know, how does that feel different to you? Do you feel like they're kindred things? Do you try to sort of reflect the book in the writing of the review?
Like the writing of my own book?
Like when you're writing a review, are you thinking about, like, what happens if the author reads it? Or are you thinking about, you know, like, who's your audience for that?
Well, my thought was, first, depending on what publication you're in. So, for example, take Portland newspapers. If you're writing a review for the Willamette Week, your readership is going to be far different than the Sunday Oregonian readership. Mm-hmm. So I let that dictate a little bit how I said what I said. But I think the jury's still on how to, quote unquote, write a book review. The New York Times book review, which is generally considered the best place to get opinions about books. Mm-hmm. They do peer reviews, which means if you have a book out and you're relatively similar to me as a writer and your book, they'll ask you to review my book, thinking you're maybe the expert in the field on this, so peer review this book, which I think has some inherent dangers because why would I go, if you're my peer, why would I go in public and not review your book strongly? That just seemed like you could set yourself up for some bad relationships in your field. In any case, the way that I thought about a book review was you're trying to determine what you want to read. So I would just say, here's what this book is generally about, and here's the way that it's written. If you like these books, you'll probably also really like this book. If you're generally this type of reader, this is probably not going to be for you. So I just tried to set up for you what the writer's attempting to accomplish and then how well he or she did or did not accomplish that thing that they seem to be setting out to do.
I see. So kind of like a YouTube comment. I'm joking.
Exactly like that.
They're notoriously bad. So you are, if I'm not mistaken, an editor of Bone Shaker magazine. Is this correct?
Correct. I'm the founding editor of that, which I think I started about in 2006.
Okay. Tell me about the magazine.
So in 2006, I had just got done with a graduate degree in English, and my specialty was 18th century Scottish literature, which is, as you might imagine, very useful in today's society. And I was yearning for something a little bit more practical to either study or write about or consume my time with, and I had, for my whole life, ridden bicycles, used it as a primary mode of transportation out on those plains in Colorado, where my mom says, sure, you could go to Scott's house down the way, but I'm not taking you. So I had to huff myself 7 miles down the country road to get to my friend's house. So I had always sort of conceived of bicycling. And so now I have these two English degrees, and I want to be a writer, and I've done some book reviews, and I really like bicycles. And I thought, gosh, I don't see anything out in the world about bicycles that I would really want to read. You see glossy magazines about racing bikes. You see glossy magazines about mountain bikes. You see all of that sort of stuff, ad-filled. And I thought, where is kind of the artistic look at bike riding? Where is people writing short stories about bicycles, poetry about bicycles, drawing bicycles? So I conceived of it as this almanac, this catch-all. And yeah, the first issue I think came out in about 2006, 2007, after working for about 9 months to solicit really strong writing for it, so that when the first issue comes out, more when people pick it up, they kind of have a sense of what they're getting in the issues that follow. So now I'm into issue 10, will come out this summer. It was supposed to be twice a year, but it sometimes it's only once a year. It depends on how much time I have.
Okay.
So that's how I got that started.
So I take it you still ride a bicycle.
I do. I commuted in this morning from the other side of Mount Tabor, right, which is 6.5 miles in, 6.5 miles back.
Yeah.
So,
what kind of bike do you ride?
I have many, many, many bikes, but the bike that I have set up as a commuter right now is just a pretty cheaply made Chinese bike called a Linus. And so I just outfitted it pretty simply and have a basket on the front to carry my shoes and lunch.
There you go. Simple. So you're not, do you see bike riders in certain sort of stereotypical categories? Like, you know, like, is yours like a, I take it from the way you described your bike, you are not a super hardcore biker, but then you also said you have a lot of bikes. Like, why did you choose that one? And are you like really into like the fixed gear, cleaned up, you know, Portland stereotype of a bicycle?
You asked several questions there.
Yes.
I think the first one was, do I see biking in these stereotypical categories?
Yes.
It's kind of difficult not to see certain categories. I have a nickname for the guys that are bedazzled in their spandex and their logos, and I just always call them squiddies. Like, they're just always it's like squid suits, and they're out there just, they have their clip-in shoes and all of these items I do have or have had in my bicycling tenure. I don't necessarily see the need for all of that spectacle just trying to get to work. But then again, I think if people are riding bikes, they should do whatever is most comfortable for them. So if you want to wear your suit, your actual dress-up suit. I believe my boss even kind of wears his tie sometimes on his bike. Or if you want to wear your racing suit, whatever you want to do. Uh-huh. There are a lot of different categories.
Well, on a normal day like today when you biked in, did you dress differently? Or you have something you change out of? Or?
Yeah, I don't want to usually sweat up my work clothes too bad. So I wear some pants and a shirt that is they're kind of specific biking pants that are, for lack of a better word, almost capri pants or knickers that don't get caught in your in your chain.
Yeah.
And then I just wear a t-shirt and my helmet and a little hat under it.
Okay.
But yeah, then I change into my work clothes when I get to work.
So somewhat recently, you wrote your first novel.
Correct.
A Simple Machine Like the Lever.
That's true.
The protagonist is described thusly. You've probably heard this phrase. Nick's struggle to position his aesthetic within the world is the story of a perfectionist who is far from perfect, who is considerate but clumsy and maybe invisible. Is this at all autobiographical?
I like to, in the last 6 months, I heard Patrick DeWitt, who is another Portland author here who wrote The Sisters Brothers. Somebody asked him that same question when I was standing next to him, and he said very confidently, it's about 60% me and 40% something else, amalgamation of other people that he's met in his life. And I think that seems about accurate. 60% me, 40% exaggeration or other things that I've seen out in the world. But right. Yeah, there's certainly some elements that I went through to be able to write that book, I think.
How did you conceive of this? What made you decide to write this book?
Well, somewhat unsurprisingly, the main character is a bicyclist. And so here I had all these years as an editor of a bicycling publication. And I knew I wanted to try my hand at fiction. So a very good friend of mine and a very, very fantastic writer and editor said to me, you should try to write that book. And I demurred and said I didn't think I could write that book. But he said, just why don't you write a chapter for me and just send it to me? So I said I would try that. So I wrote him a chapter and sent it to him. And then he said, that's great. Let's see a second chapter and a third chapter and a fourth chapter. And so he kind of, as a very good friend and a very good editor, coaxed it out of me. And then when I got to what I thought was the end of it, he said, perfect. Now you can start over and really write it. And so then I had this framework and all this kind of description of a young 30-something, kind of really struggling to get through life. He's made some really bad financial decisions. He's made some pretty poor relationship decisions and trying to rectify that, all the while kind of riding his bike to and from work every day. And so, yeah, that's how I kind of came to be.
So did you... That's an interesting, process. Did you sort of realize the story as you were writing it on that first pass? I mean, when you were sort of being asked, just give me one chapter, were you kind of thinking about the whole picture of the story? Or were you kind of like, well, a chapter, that's easy.
Yeah. Sort of like that. A chapter okay. is easy. Since I had never written a novel before, I really didn't know how you do that. And the 2 degrees I have in English are not creative writing, they're literature, so I knew what a book looked like, but I didn't necessarily know how to get to that point. So I just went back and studied all of the books that I liked best and thought, well, how did this person create this thing? I'm not exactly sure how they created it, but it seems as though your character does this, and then dialogue looks like this, and then your description looks like this, and then you move between these conflicts thusly, but just taking it chapter by chapter, then I think about 3/4 of the way through amassing stuff, then I could kind of see the arc that I was building, which is why then the friend editor says, now this is when you start over and really, really start piecing it together so that the narrative framework works like a book and isn't just a list of disjointed chapter drafts.
Mm-hmm. How did you reach a point when you knew that you were done and how did you feel that it turned out? Like on a personal level?
I think when it first came out, I was less pleased with it than I am now. Now it's been out since 2011, so it's got a good 3.5 years under its belt. And I was really nervous to let it go into the world as this being and live its own life. For 2.5 years, I had created it. I was kind of one of the only people who had seen it. So now to let it go out into the world on its own accord was a really terrifying thing, because mm-hmm. then it reflects on me. I thought, this is so silly. What a silly, silly thing to have created. But it really resonated with a lot of people, to my surprise, which has probably built up confidence in the project. And it, I look back at it and I think, oh, right, I would have probably changed some things. But as a first book, I'm very happy with it. And my wife is fond of saying, if I wanted to, I could have probably written on it 3 more years, but it may not have been any better of a book. So yeah, at some point you have to be done, or else you turn into Walt Whitman changing Leaves of Grass 62 times. I like being done with the project and letting it go and letting it stand on its own and moving on to the next project.
Are you working on anything else? Can you tell me anything?
I can tell you that. I, about a year and a half ago, really started writing a collection of short stories, and I got, I think I made some really good headway, and then I purchased a house a year ago last Friday, as a matter of fact, and that has taken up a lot of my time in the greatest way possible. I love owning a home, and I've spent pretty much all my extracurricular time working on that house and trying to get it into a shape that I like.
First, about the short stories, though, I'm curious. Yeah. Did you actually set out to write a collection of short stories?
Yeah. So this one was a far different beginning than the first book, in that I had a very tangible idea of what I wanted this collection of stories to look like and feel like. Hmm. And so in 6 months, I think I probably got about half the manuscript to the point that I wanted it, and now I probably have another half of it, but I know exactly what I'm trying to do in this one, and I know what I want the stories to do and how many of them there are and how they work together and don't work together. I'm kind of loosely tying them together around a specific landscape, and it's that landscape of northern Colorado where I grew up. I think the more that I've moved around from Colorado to Rhode Island, where I went to graduate school, Atlanta, where I took an office job, to Portland, I've seen now just how unique that area was that I grew up, and I think there's a lot to be harvested there in fiction.
This is probably a little inside baseball, but what do you write on a laptop on Microsoft Word? Or?
Yeah, I'll take notes to myself during the day, either just in a little notepad if I think something up, or I'll send myself an email real quick, just, oh, remember you had this thought about this thing. So I just kind of keep an ongoing list. But yeah, then in the mornings, I write far better in the morning than I do at night. My creative juices are just more potent between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. than they are even 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Usually at the end of the day, I'm pretty cashed out. So if I can get up and have coffee and go at it for about 2 hours, I can't really write more than 3 hours at a time if it's generative, if I'm creating stuff. If I then turn my attention to editing after that, I can maybe span 6 hours, but maybe it's still some of that ADD I had as a kid where I want to get outside. But so I write on a laptop and then save my versions and then go back and forth between them.
I see. What do you presently do for a living?
Right now, I'm the communications manager at Literary Arts, a nonprofit here in town that Need More has made the brand new, beautiful website for.
That's right, and yeah, I've been a fan of Literary Arts forever. What is it that you do? And yeah, tell me about what you do there.
So, as communications manager, I oversee and am the project manager of basically our online presence, so our website, updating that after it was built by you all, really reflecting what we're up to, just making sure it's always up to date. And then I run all of our print collateral with our other design firm that designs it. And so I oversee all of the print programs for Portland Arts and Lectures, or the solicitation letters that go out from the office, or yeah, any real print collateral that comes out of the office, I oversee.
And that design work is with the fine people at AHA.
That's correct.
In Vancouver, Canada, right?
Right here, Washington.
Washington.
Right across the river.
Yes. It's not that far. Nice. I'm curious about your house. What have you done? What have you been busy doing to it? Like, what kind of projects do you like to take on? Are you handy?
I think there was a latent handiness to me that I had forgotten over 10 to 12 years of apartment living. But
right.
There was, again, back to that landscape of northern Colorado, I really can't remember a weekend that I wasn't outside working on cars with my dad, or building a treehouse, or cleaning out the gutters, or landscaping something, or putting in a garden, or mowing the field, or digging tree stumps out of the septic field, like all the time doing some sort of project. But like I said, having moved to and from cities for the last decade and a half, I hadn't really been up to that stuff. But then when I moved in, my wife and I, we knew that if we ever got a piece of property, we wanted to try to grow some food on it. So we, in the first year, dug out the front lawn and most of the back lawn and put in 8 raised beds in each. So we have 16 raised beds, a compost bin, and then a garage where we've started seeds for this year and some tools to do some work. And I'm in the process of building a chicken run so that we can have some egg-laying hens back in the backyard.
You guys are going to be fully ready for the coming apocalypse, aren't you?
Or something.
Yeah, that's great.
The number of people that drive by the front yard and stop their car and roll down the window and say, wow, I remember when my parents did this as like a victory garden back in the 50s.
I
was really surprised by the number of people that it seemed to resonate with, and they loved that we were doing that to the lawn. I was afraid that they would react negatively and that why are you putting these boxes in the front yard? But we've only had really, really positive response.
Yeah. No, that makes a huge difference. We put those boxes in our last house, and it was so much nicer. And it's easier to grow stuff. Like the water doesn't just sit in there, and
the soil's way better. It's easier to tend.
Exactly.
It just kind of keeps it down, compartmentalized rather than just a mass of growth.
And with kids, it's like, you know, as you know, we have a couple kids. It's impossible to like train them where exactly to walk. But once we put in the raised beds, it was like, well, it's pretty obvious now where you shouldn't walk. Right.
Stay out of the bed, stay out of the pathway.
Yeah. Where do you see, Literary Arts is celebrating, I think it's 30th anniversary now.
Yeah, this fall.
Like what sort of big things are coming up for Literary Arts this year for all of that? And like, what do you have to deal with for that?
Well, we just announced our 2014-2015 season of Portland Arts and Lectures that begins in October.
Yeah.
So that opens with James McBride, and then there's a nonfiction writer that comes next, Elizabeth Colbert. Then we have one of my favorite writers, Michael Chabon, coming in January. And then we have, after that, Ruth Ozeki, who I've never read, but I'm excited to hear because she's also a Zen Buddhist priest and a fiction writer and a screenwriter. So I'm very interested in how that plays out. Then we close with an investigative journalist named Catherine Boo in April. So we have that, and then we'll kick off some 30th anniversary festivities that kind of last a majority of the season. There's a birthday bash that it's going to have some big name writers that I'm not allowed to say yet, but that's going to happen. We're reintroducing a series downtown called Poetry Downtown, where 3 big poets will come over the course of the winter and give presentations. And then we're also relaunching Poetry in Motion, which is the poems that you see on TriMet, on the buses, on the trains, and they're going to expand this year to be on the bus stops and the bus shelters. So we're doing that as well.
Right. That was my first, probably a lot of people's first, encounter with Literary Arts. Is I remember when it was probably not long after I moved here, and this was like, probably I remember this from the late 90s, seeing those on the bus and just being like, that is so cool. They have poems on the buses here. It seems like that sort of faded out, and now it's coming back, which is exciting.
I believe Portland was one of the pilot cities for Poetry in Motion. So back in the 90s is when they first started it. And then, it's been that some of those same poems have been on the bus for a while since the mid-2000s, and now we're doing a refresh. So that's also exciting. Lots happening for the 30th.
Where do you get those poems from? Is it like student work?
Yeah, this time around, it's going to be, I believe, a 3-part culling. One is going to be nationally known poets, and we're pairing with the Academy of American Poetry, I believe, and then local poets, and then some student work. So 1/3 of each of those, and then to be decided by the public which ones we feature.
I see. As communications director, how much of your day is spent writing email, and how much of it is spent on the phone?
I'd say email is close to 85% of the day.
It's a lot. That's higher than I was expecting. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
But it could be lower if I made more phone calls, but as a writer, I really like to communicate via email.
I'm the same way. I would much rather, because I feel like, and I hopefully none of our clients are listening to this. I'm only kind of joking, but sometimes I feel like having a face-to-face meeting is almost like a cop-out, because when you have to write it down, like I feel like writing clearly is thinking clearly, and it forces you to spend your time thinking through what you're trying to say, distilling it into something coherent beforehand, and then the person who receives it has the courtesy of only having to spend 5 minutes reading it, and it's very clear, and I'm trying to promote that. I like that. I think email is a bad name. I think email is a great tool. And frankly, I don't get spam anymore. So I think I like email is what I'm saying.
I love that process of writing both fiction and even non-fiction communicative mm-hmm. work, like an email, being forced to try to say a thing as clearly and as true as possible within the confines of a sentence. Mm-hmm. The sentence then for me takes on this whole... It becomes an art form in itself, this mm-hmm. sentence. How are you saying what you have to say? Because it's so easy to write a sentence that doesn't say anything. Mm-hmm. But it's so much more difficult to say a sentence that's both true and says something necessary. So, mm-hmm.
yeah.
I love it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me, Evan.
Absolutely. I've loved every second.
Thanks.
Ray?
Can.
Do you know anything about cars? Like, if someone were to say, which is a more Portland car, a Subaru or a Jeep or a Prius, what would you say? Cooler? I don't know.
Probably a Prius.
Really?
I don't know.
Okay.
All of them are arguably could be Portlandish cars, although... they all have very, very deep stereotypes that I'm not going to go into.
I don't know these stereotypes, so... Boy, I mean, you could go into the Prius one because that's our car, so we're not going to be too offended, are we, if we're talking about ourselves?
When you think of a Prius, you think of a... the guy driving it is like a sort of a skinny 50-something guy who was a hippie, who's like really... really concerned about the environment, maybe still hides a bead necklace under his Hawaiian shirt.
What?
And shorts, and like is kind of like has graying hair, but he might still wear a ponytail. And
I totally thought the Prius was the new station wagon, like the mom and pop car of Portland. Like you're all fine and good, and then you have a Volvo, and then you have kids, and you get a Prius, right? That's what happened to us. And that's it.
No, that's more the Subaru.
You have a Subaru, then you have kids and you get a Prius, or you have a...
No. I think a lot of people have kids and they would have like the Subaru wagon and,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, it'll be that forest green, like you can almost smell it and it's like, ooh, really fill
up. I want a forest green car.
No, it's a piece of
that's
crap.
Awesome.
It's an awful car.
What?
And then... those aren't even the same people who would get the Prius. Oh. Like, people with families, they just...
Does the Prius come in green? A forest green?
No.
That sounds like a really cool color for a car.
No, the thing about the Prius is that it actually lets the forests exist, so you don't need to color the Prius like the forest.
No, I think that's the bicycle.
Yeah, probably. Like... the Subaru is colored to look like the forest
off the
that
Subaru,
it's replacing.
And then my experience of Jeeps are that I remember riding around in like a 70s Jeep and it got like 12 miles to the gallon. Mm-hmm. It was awful gas mileage. But
well, that's because Jeeps are designed to drive through, I don't know, like the mountains in the Sonoma mm-hmm. Desert.
Yeah.
Over nothing but potholes.
Yeah.
Like, they're intended
to
bounce.
They're so
like
cool,
like,
though. I always wanted a Jeep.
Screw Jeeps.
Really? Okay, so, gotta go.
Why? Oh, the phone?
Yeah, the phone.
Okay, we'll wait for you. We'll just keep rolling. Okay. Someone's already got it.